You're listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
All right. Welcome to the UCB Long-Form Conversations podcast from Los Angeles, California. I'm Johnny Meeks, and I'm the host of today's episode. And the guest is artistic director Mike Still.
Hi, Johnny.
Hi, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on my show for today.
This is yours. This is all yours.
Yeah. So this is like the first one for Los Angeles.
Yeah, this is the first.
The first one. We're the inaugural team.
Yeah. We broke a champagne bottle over the computer.
And broke it. I want to tell everyone how this works.
How does this work?
This works in the following way.
So you're the host forever.
I'm the host. No.
For the rest of time.
Good question. You're the host on the next episode.
What?
Mike. Yes. It goes guest, host, right?
So I'm guest now, and you're going to ask me questions about my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then next week or I'll be the host?
Yeah, you'll be the host. You'll be interviewing someone else.
My God.
Isn't that amazing? And then that person will interview someone else.
It's like Daisy Chain.
Yeah. Or La Ronde.
What's La Ronde? I know Daisy Chain's because it's a type of bomb where you drop a bunch of bombs and one goes off and then it ignites the next one to go off.
Right. And it's also like a gross term for a sexual thing.
Oh, I don't know anything about sex.
Come on.
I'm into war.
Come on.
More of a war man than a sex man.
Maybe it's not gross. I shouldn't have put that judgment on it.
Could you not slut shame me?
And we're going to, on this podcast, talk about fascinating people in the world of long-form improv, and you are one of those.
Oh, God.
You're a fascinating person.
Thank you.
In the world of long-form improv. Here's the problem with this La Ronde, though, which we were just talking about. I'm going to be the host the first time, but I don't get to be a guest.
You don't get—
Like, ever. Like,
you get
no
to,
one will find out anything about how I feel about long-form improv.
But just like in a La Ronde, which is like a character wheel sort of thing, someone in the first scene is in the last scene.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of like Pulp Fiction. That's a way to think about La Ronde. That's an all jumbled up La Ronde. Look.
So the problem is, how do you figure out what's the last episode of this podcast?
I don't know. Probably when Civil War II happens.
Okay.
Again, I'm a war person.
Yeah.
And
I'm a sex person.
You're
so.
A sex person. And I'm pretty sure that the second Civil War will happen. Just like the first one was started when Lincoln— was elected and South Carolina seceded. We're going to see that when Trump is elected. And
so pretty soon. Pretty soon this is going to.
Yeah.
And so we'll probably not be able to hear from great luminaries like Billy Merritt or Julie Brister.
Yeah. That'll be it.
That'll be it.
In the next 9 months.
And everyone will be dead.
And, you know, what's fun about podcasts is that even though we're recording this right now.
Hey, Mike, what's fun about podcasts?
Oh, thank you. Is that you guys are going to be listening to this after the fall of America and be like, they were prescient. They were right.
Yeah. They'll be in their bomb shelters having daisy chain orgies.
Exactly.
Ah. Well, that's the end of the podcast, everyone.
Got to get out of here.
We completed it. So tell us, you're currently the artistic director of UCB Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, yeah, which is the entertainment capital of California.
Is it?
Yeah.
I would think Sacramento, but okay. And you're also a featured player on the team Tuesday Club.
Yes, Tuesday Club. Every Tuesday at 7 at UCB Theater Franklin, or UCB Franklin as we call it.
Right, which is not UCB Sunset.
No, Sunset is where we're in right now.
That's right. And what other shows are you doing at UCB Los Angeles?
I host a show called Star Punch, which is the best of show. We get a lot of great sketches and stand-ups from around the other shows, and they do it.
But no long-form improv on that show.
No, so we let's not talk about that. But a show called The Fuck Around that Thomas Middleditch and I do.
Right.
And that's a fun show. We often do La Ronde's in that.
Yeah.
It's us and two guests. And, gosh, what else do I do? Ask Cat sometimes and you know, used to be on Your Fucked Up Family, which was Death by Ruru before that. Mm-hmm. And Diamond Lion on Friday nights, we used to do that. But those teams are, you know, gone now.
They've, yeah.
Just as, you know, everything goes. Everything goes back to Ash.
Improv graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
So sad.
So sad.
So tell us how you got into this. Tell us about the first, let's start here. Tell us about the first UCB show you saw.
The first UCB show I saw was The Swarm.
Hmm.
I'm pretty sure it was The Swarm.
That's a good one.
It may have been Stepfathers, but I don't know. Like, some of The Swarm became Stepfathers. And that's at UCB New York. And I remember Billy Merritt.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a special guest, Chris Gethard.
Mm-hmm.
And they were awesome. And Gethard made a Star Wars reference, which I was like, whoa. I love it.
It blew you away.
Yeah, I mean, because this was like, you know, 2000-something, and Star Wars was, you know, not as... There's a Star Wars resurgence right now.
Right.
So it's like, how did he know who Bib Fortuna was? I was very impressed. And that's, you know, yeah.
No one knows who Bib Fortuna is. That's amazing. And so did you just wander in off the street, or did someone tell you about UCB, or how did you go to the Swarm show?
I was dating someone that was in Will Hines' 101 class.
Oh.
Yeah. So
so we have her to thank.
Yes.
For Mike Still.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you, whoever you were.
Whoever you are. Thank you. And so I was, you know, you got to see a couple shows if you're a student. And beyond that, it's fun. It's, you know, they're actually enjoyable. It's not just because you have to.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We hope.
We hope.
We hope they're enjoyable.
Yeah, yeah. I think they are. So went and saw The Swarm. Had a really great time. And it was at UCB Chelsea, and it was a, you know, maybe Friday. I think they performed on Fridays. Maybe it was Saturday. But it was the weekend, and it was raining, so it wasn't very crowded. It was me and my little brother who was in town and, you know, heard a couple friends. And it was like the theater was empty, and it just felt like, you know, it was kind of a special time in UCB's history, because it really did feel like a thing that no one else had seen or knew about.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, this is cool. This is like an inside sort of in the basement. It felt like a real, like, ooh, I'm in the inner circle of like the comedy, you know.
You felt like a punk rock guy.
I felt like a punk rock guy.
1973.
I absolutely did. Listening to Huey Lewis Fortuna. In the news. Bib Fortuna. All the big bands.
Was there like a moment in that show that kind of was like a big aha thing for you that said, I want to do this? Do you know?
I think it was just the show kind of in general.
Yeah.
Really, that Bib Fortuna thing is the only thing I remember from it.
Yeah.
But just in general, being like, these guys were like really funny, and they felt like they were being funny by being themselves. It wasn't like a huge, like, oh, everyone's doing these like enormous characters or anything like that. They were just being funny, and you know what I'd later know is being called working at the top of their intelligence. So it felt like seeing something really cool. Then I went and saw another show, which I later found out was Cage Match, like going back through my own personal archaeology and figuring out like what was that show, because it was really bad.
I imagine you had like a wall and like ticket stubs and and yarn between
lines
thumb text
and stuff and like,
and you found out what this show was.
Yeah,
and
I beautiful minded it out. And it was Cage Match, so half of it was really good. It was what I later knew was, is it No Posers, that musical group that like Bobby Moynihan and
I'd never seen it, but that sounds familiar to me.
I think that's what it was. And someone can go and check the math on this if they go into the Cage Match archives. But
probably
it was,
Jake Riegel get on that.
Totally. And it was a shout out to Jake there. So it was, I think, Havana Clambake. And I know, I mean, it was like John Gabris and stuff, who later, you know, even then you can see people being really funny. Just the team itself wasn't gelling.
Yeah.
It was a team called Havana Clambake. So, and I remember it was like a scene where there was like a Starbucks that had like a cow in it, or the cow was like making coffee milk or whatever. or, you know, lattes were coming out of the cow.
Right.
And I was just like, Jesus Christ.
Come on, guys.
Come on, guys.
And, get it together.
And at the time, I was a big sketch comedy snob. I was doing a lot of sketch comedy in New York and Brooklyn and the underground places like, you know, Rafifi and Galapagos.
Yeah,
and, you know,
Mike has actually lit up a cigarette and put on a scarf as he's talking.
Yeah, back when we weren't handed everything. Oh, here's your team. Go make great stuff. No. We had to go out and work for it.
Did you do short form before UCB? You were just into sketch comedy. You weren't doing improv at all.
In New York, I was doing a lot of sketch comedy, and but in college and before that, we did like my theater group would do short form.
Once a semester.
Right. What is that arbitrary time frame? Semester.
Yeah.
Once a semester, we would do short form improv, and it was a little bit like, I think at the time, everyone was kind of getting a little bit snobby about short form improv because it kind of feels so cheesy, you know? It's fun, but it is cheesy.
Yeah.
And that's okay to say.
It's okay to say.
It's okay to
like short form improv.
It's okay to like it too. We all have different tastes and we're all individuals.
We're all human beings.
Ugh. It's disgusting. So like, I'm being human. And I did improv at the Pennsylvania Renaissance Fair also. It was like the first place I really learned what improv was.
You and I have this similar background where we did Ren Fairs and National Players, a touring Shakespeare company.
What what Ren Fair were you involved in?
Maryland.
Maryland. Oh, that's right. Not Sterling. That's up in New York, but yeah.
Yeah, no, Maryland. Quality Ren Fair.
You guys have that forest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had did you have Star Trek weekend?
There was often it? Were, yeah, where people would come through and Star Trek. Oh,
that was when I felt like killing myself.
Oh, my. There's a video, a web series called All's Fair that I was involved with like 7 or 8 years ago. Tom Woodley, who's really great, and Bob McClure of McClure's Pickles. They wrote it.
Sure.
Yeah, McClure's Pickles. Checking out. They're very good. And there's an episode, and I played this like a guy who's pretending to be a Scottish guy at a Ren Fair. And there's an episode where the time travelers from the future always come, because that's always what would happen in Star Trek weekend, is the time travelers from the future would come and they'd be like, here we are in the Renaissance time.
Right, and they'd hold their tricorder up to you. And
there's an episode that UCB people would be interested in because Terry Withers of the Terry Withers Mysteries in New York plays a guy being a Vulcan and being just a total dick to everyone.
I want to see that.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you said in the Swarm show, one of the things that appealed to you was playing to the height of your intelligence. Like that was something that hooked you into that. And that my first UCB show that I saw in 2005 was ASCAT, and it was only Matt Besser and Andy Daly, just the two of them.
Oh, that's so fun.
So great. And I remember there was a suggestion that was vaguely art-related, and Matt, of course, knows a lot about art. And he just kind of led Andy Daly on this tour through this gallery and was using all these accurate and very specific art terms about what they were looking at in each painting. And that went on, it felt like a long time. And then at the very end of it, Andy Daly just looked at him and said, I don't know what you're talking about. And it was a huge laugh. And that was a big aha moment for me. It was like, oh, you can say that in improv? Because I'd been doing just short form and, you know.
And short form's like a lot of it's based around who has the most clever answer, who can answer this. What's your answer?
And it's never honest. It's never true. And
that's
the thing that kind of like there was a ding that went off in my head. And so I got to take classes here.
You know, I actually now that's jogging my memory. I remember Billy Merritt calling Gethard a nerd and just being like, you can't just say Star Wars stuff and expect any. All right, sir. Sure. Go ahead and Star Wars. Yep. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
And like totally made fun of him.
Yeah.
And that was from like a top of your intelligence response.
Right.
You know, I guess that's the way of justifying someone making fun of someone else on stage. But
it's a classic Billy Merritt move.
Yeah.
To belittle somebody on stage.
Yep.
I love him.
It's too bad he won't be on until the world ends.
That's right. So then what happened after you saw these shows and you got hooked into this? You started taking classes?
I started taking classes. I was, again, involved in my sketch comedy group, A Week of Kindness.
big shout out to A Week of Kindness.
Go to our YouTube. Last time we uploaded something was in 2009.
Great.
The golden age of our stuff was like 2007, 2008. We're on the front of MySpace a lot.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. I mean, I think we all know about a state of kindness, right?
A week of kindness.
MySpace. State of kindness is better.
A static kindness?
Static kindness is better.
This is my sketch group, a static kindness. You're like, all right.
Why are they introducing that group in such a severe, yeah, serious way?
So dire. Welcome to Static Kinnis. Organ music. Yeah, so then I took classes in like 2006 or so. I think I've told this story on a podcast before, but I helped out.
Well, if you don't want to tell it, you don't have to tell it.
I should tell it.
Yeah.
Because this is like a UCB thing.
Yeah.
That people, this is where actually people would care
this
about
this is
it.
Where you fall in love with long-form improv.
This is, yeah, they have a conversation
the first
about
act
it.
Of a beautiful romantic comedy between you and long-form improv.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? Right now you're probably hearing music if you're...
Yeah. Alexis is going to put music under this.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Some French horns.
Totally. So I, in the one-on-one class that that the person I was dating was in, she was like, can you help me make... She's like, I want to make t-shirts for Will Hines. What? Oh, cool. Like, you guys, you like do. Wear it? She's like, no, we'll all wear the t-shirts out. The class wants to do this. We're all going to wear t-shirts that have Will Hines' face on it. So I'd met Will Hines once. Mm-hmm. After you know, a class, everyone had went out to the bars, whatever, and I met this guy, and it's like, he loves improv, but he's a software engineer. Mm-hmm. That's like what was Will Hines' description in 2005. And so I photoshopped this photo of Will Hines, and I always go back and look for it periodically, can never find it. And then everyone came out in the 101 show with matching shirts that had, mm-hmm, Will Hines' face on it.
That's great.
Yeah.
And then, but you weren't in that class.
Sorry, so I wasn't in that class. And then I started taking, like, in 2006, took a 101 improv class with Amy Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. She's, mm-hmm, a great writer and performer. And then I had Anthony King in 201. And 301 was like this mishmash of, it was Gethard and Wengert and Kevin Mulaney.
Mm-hmm.
401, I don't know if this is interesting to anyone, but 401 was Jason Mantzoukas.
Mm-hmm.
501, which we had at the time, was Billy Merritt. Mm-hmm. And then I did a ninja class with Billy Merritt after, mm-hmm, that. And then I stopped. I did musical improv with Liza Skinner, a couple levels of that. But then I stopped. I didn't take a billion classes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fine to
that's
not
okay.
take a billion classes.
It's okay. You don't have to take every class.
Don't Please. Don't, you don't need to take every class. Come on.
And then you auditioned for a Herald team?
I got on, yeah. My first round, I did not get on one. And then second time I auditioned, I did on, you know, fucking $12,000 it's called.
$12,000.
Which everyone thought was called that because it was the amount of money that one team, you know, of eight people taking five classes, that's about how much it would cost. And that wasn't true.
What was the truth?
We just thought it was a funny number. It's like a good
12,000?
We thought it was a good number because it's like that's enough. That's like amount of money that you would get. And it would like make a big difference. It would make a difference in your life, but it wouldn't change your life.
Yeah.
But that's profoundly.
Not, is that funny?
We just thought it was an interesting number.
Interesting number.
Yeah. That it, like,
a funny
not,
number is like
69.
Yeah.
But it's like not actually funny because it's like, all right.
Because it's sexy?
Yeah, it's not war. That's why I'm 666.
I think like $17,500 is a funny number.
It's a specific number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes me laugh.
$17,500.
Yeah. You should rethink that name. That's
I will.
All I'm saying.
Yeah, I'll go back and find the email chain and rethink that name. But yeah, I got on a Herald team and it's great, great Herald team.
Great. did it last long?
About a year.
Yeah, that's how long they usually last.
Yeah.
Or many of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had, we thought we were going to make it over the hump, but hey, so it goes. Shakeups happen.
Yeah.
And it was.
I feel like I've heard that out of your mouth before.
Shakeups happen?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I have to tell people now.
Get that on a t-shirt.
Hey, shakeups happen. It's great.
Great. What's the first year of, do you remember being, your first year of, on this team? Like, what's that like?
You know, I think that there was a lot of, you know, imposter syndrome. You know the term imposter syndrome?
No.
It's basically a thing that people feel when they're not like, they're like, why did I get this?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the psychological reaction to being in a position or getting something where you, and it stems from feelings of like inadequacy or whatever. You're like, why me versus anyone else?
Yeah.
And I think it was a lot of like really like, that's kind of how I felt. That's how a bunch of people on the team felt. Like, what are we doing? We can't be doing this,
yeah,
right? Like, we're not good enough. We don't know how to do the Herald. We don't know what
wow
we're doing.
Like, but nobody felt. Like, I don't want to say, I deserve to be here.
Well, people felt like they deserved to be there, but we were all like, oh shit, we don't really know what's
yeah.
how to do this.
Yeah.
But then what it turns out is that imposter syndrome is actually, this is now like a compliment to the team, is that like kind of like it's something that happens when people with good taste or high intellect get things.
Oh.
Dumb people don't have imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
People without taste or anything, because they're just like, yeah, I fucking deserve this.
Yeah.
I'm an idiot.
I think I'm a dumb person, Mike.
Oh, so you it's not, yeah, you can still feel like you deserve something.
No, I didn't necessarily feel like I deserved it, but I was so out of touch with the reality of Herald Knight the first couple of years that we were on Herald Knight. Like, I didn't realize, oh, we could be cut or
anything like that.
Anything like that. I was having babies and just had a whole other life going on. So I wasn't obsessing over every little note we got. And then when teams start to get cut, I was like, oh, this is for real.
But that's good. You have probably had a healthy work-life balance.
I think so.
That's important.
Yeah. And yours wasn't healthy.
No. I mean, we're all just in this, like, it's like, okay, well, I need a break from improv to go do my sketch comedy. Mm-hmm. It was like, that was it. You know,
yeah.
26 in New York doing that.
Right.
Going out to bars.
Right.
It was great.
Time of your life.
It was really fun.
You were a young Turk.
Young Turk. None of us knew anything about the industry. No one had any idea. We did have someone that became very famous on our team, Aubrey Plaza, and she was like the only
Who's
one.
Who's that?
She was on Parks and Recreation.
Okay.
She was in Dirty
describe
Grandpa.
Describe what she looks like.
She's brunette.
oh, I know her.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and she was the only one that was like auditioning for stuff during $12,000, right towards the end of that year, is when she got on Funny People in the movie Funny People, which really launched her. And we all were like, what's she doing? She's missing a hard rehearsal?
Yeah.
For what?
For an audition?
Okay. We just didn't know.
Yeah.
Now out here, there's such a high level of awareness of everything. Yeah. People get on Herald Knight and they already have a manager, an agent, and TV show and everything. It's crazy.
Right. But you did it for the love of long form improv.
We were in it for the love of long form improv.
Yeah. What did you love about it? In those days, was it like? Like, you'll answer later. You will about now. What do you love about it? In those days, what was it?
I think I love that it was hard. I like the challenge of it. That it wasn't something that was like, all right, this is like. It felt as though that it's engaging your mind and engaging your your creative process in a way that like. You're not getting in some other things. Like, you're on your feet. It felt like a game. It felt like this is a cool, weird game that we're getting out here and jumping into. And, we get to make the audience laugh. And they're very much engaged with you in this. They see you trying to put this stuff together, trying to make it work. And there's something really special about, doing Herald Knight at Chelsea, and it's a huge crowd of 220 other people that are like very similar mindset, similar taste. It just felt so great to do.
There's nothing like that energy.
Yeah, that energy was just
like you can't
fantastic.
Get it back with Tuesday Club, or I can't get it back with Sentimental Lady.
I don't think you can. Like, I think that, like, especially out here, our audiences are more tourist based. They're more coming to UCB for good reason to see like great shows, but they're not. They're not like in it in the way that like a Chelsea audience was at 8 p.m. on a Monday or Tuesday. Yeah. I guess Herald Knight was Tuesday out there. It's just not the same. You know, I think you still get that in Herald Knight here.
Yeah.
It's really great. But I always remember that, like, getting notes from whoever of like, all right, well, that's a Herald Knight audience and this and that. And I'm like, why are we belittling this audience? And then I'm like, oh, this note comes from a place of jealousy.
Yeah.
This is not a note about, like, be ready for the real audiences, because there are no fucking real audiences.
Right.
An audience is an audience. There's no more audience that's more valid or less valid than anything else. This is a note coming from jealousy. Sure, you can make a Herald Knight audience laugh. You're like, it's more like, I want to make that audience laugh, and I do it better.
I miss it.
Yeah.
Any team that I talk to that's been promoted off of Herald Knight misses it.
Absolutely.
Good days. I'm feeling a little sad right now.
It's okay to be nostalgic for times lost. But think about the future times.
This podcast is a lot about it's okay to feel things, which I think is great.
I think it's all right to feel things.
It's great. So did you get put on multiple Herald teams? You got put on one after?
$12,000 went away. We thought we were good. And then we got, like, someone was like, hey, I just talked to someone and maybe we shouldn't think we're good. That's what we would call a leak.
Oh,
a leak shit. From the Herald Committee. Maybe we shouldn't think we're good.
What a terrible thing to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all sitting around McManus and yeah. So then I was on a team called Bangs, which was a really fun team, a very playful team. And then I was on a team called Bad Man, which is also great. And that stayed around for a while and became Airwolf. And then I went on to do Death by Ruru, which was a lot of fun.
That's a famous team.
I guess it was in the improv world. And I was like one of the last, you know, a couple waves of people being added. So I'm probably like one of the people that ruined Death by Ruru. So
yeah,
that's how
they blame you.
Yeah. You know, blame me for not being able to recapture there.
What about, did you have this sense of like, I love doing the Herald and I love being on a Herald team. But what I really want is to do this with a long form improv. Did you have that kind of sense?
I think that the Herald form itself and Herald Night with eight people on it, you'd sometimes get the feeling of like, oh, let's breathe a bit. We need to breathe.
Yeah.
We want some space.
Right.
I need to like slow, like you, because you get into kind of a like, oh, there's so much on. So many of us on stage, we all got to make moves.
Yeah.
We got to be heightening these second beats. We got to be coming up with, you know, great connections at the end and tag runs and all that stuff.
And some nights you just initiate a group game and do a support move and that's it.
And that's it. Yeah. Yeah. And so getting, going from Herald Night and getting to do Fucked Up Family, got to do the mono scene, which I was just love that form.
Yeah.
And, you know, Fucked Up Family at the time had, we'd probably have an average of four or five people every Saturday when we do our show. I'm sorry, Death by Ruru, not Fucked Up Family. That was the name of our show, which then became
right.
Name.
It's look, so confusing.
It's arcane stuff, right? So we would do the mono scene, which is just one long scene. It's set in one spot. And it was great. It was so much fun. It was just so wonderful to do. You really got to create a world. You get to have persistent characters that you can keep coming back to.
Yeah.
And I still love the Herald. I think that it's a great improv form, and I appreciate it now more than I think I even did on Herald Night.
Yeah.
But the mono scene is something that I, one of the improv forms that can really become a piece of art, even more than a piece of pop art, if that makes sense, even more than a sense of like, this is something very satisfying for the audience.
Yeah.
Which is great and important. And a lot of what we do at UCB. But it's also one of, like, mono scene, you're like, oh, this is where we can make, if we want to, if that's the vibe of the night and that's how we're feeling, this can be something that transcends sort of funny boys and girls doing funny things, you know?
You get that, I agree with that idea of you get to sit with a character is so satisfying and also really hard.
Yeah.
Really hard to do that for a half hour.
Yeah.
And keep playing a game with the character and make it satisfying.
Yeah.
But that it, when you do it, it's the best feeling.
It's great.
It's the best feeling.
And that's what you like had to know about like the mono scene was that like the people that could stick with one character and stick with like one strong point of view that they're going after, one strong want that their character is going after. And every time they go after that want and, you know, usually some sort of obstacle gets in their way. And that's when the comedy gets created. That's when the game gets played.
Yeah.
The people that could really stick with like one thing and do it. The best Death by Ruru mono scenes, it was, you know, six maniacs trying to get something that they wanted.
Yeah.
And maybe it was all different. Maybe it was together having a joint thing that they were trying to get. Maybe it was a couple pairs that wanted one thing or whatever.
Yeah.
But seeing that all interplay is the closest thing you can get to true live watching a play on stage.
Yeah. We can geek out because this is kind of a geeky
podcast,
but it goes back to just basic theater elements of what do I want?
Yeah.
What's in my way?
Totally.
What do I do to get over that?
Yeah.
And that's what makes that form really fascinating.
Yeah.
So which means that you love that form so much you teach it.
Yeah. I've taught a mono scene class or two. Yeah.
Yeah. And your students love it. I read all their evaluations.
Oh, thank God.
What's like the thing you say on the first day about mono scenes?
I start out by really like examining how the mono scene is this way to get these characters together and get them going after the things that they want, right? Like, because you need to think about things in a little bit more of an actory standpoint than you would in like a 2-minute improv scene, right? Mm-hmm. Because like those scenes are great, and having like a character with a want or whatever helps for me like solidify like what the game is in a scene, or at least think about it in a way that's like, ooh, I can work this. This is a something that is actionable. This can inform my behavior, right? So mm-hmm. having that this mono scene is this way of taking all these characters with different objectives, putting them in a space together, and then just letting it play out, mm-hmm. right? The thing that I really try to start out in these classes and start out when I'm teaching mono scene or when I'm thinking about mono scene is that the mono scene itself needs to have structure within it. Just like a movie or just like a TV show, you need to think about it in terms of like this is being broken down into discrete scenes within the mono scene. Mm-hmm. So even though that this is a mono scene that's set in a teacher's lounge, or this is a mono scene that's set in a Subway sandwich place, which there's a great one online, a Death by Ruru mono mm-hmm. scene that Nate Dern filmed before he was artistic director and with three cameras and stuff. So if you search,
Is it on MySpace also?
It's on MySpace.com. Great. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or there.
Yeah. There's a band called, Death by Ruru, and they.
So he shot it with three cameras?
He shot it with three cameras,
wow.
Yeah.
I do want to see this.
Yeah, you should watch it. I think it's called Karl Marx is the name of it. So if you search Death by Ruru, Karl Marx mono scene on YouTube, you'll find it. Yeah. But looking at like the scene is like having structure within it, mm-hmm. having a way to say like this scene is ending, let's get in another scene, and then giving people the tools to do that, the different ways of like thinking about how you're setting yourself up little spaces for scenes within this like larger mm-hmm. structure is kind of how I teach that.
Yeah. Do you ever dream about improv?
I actually did have a dream once about improv where I was at my grandfather's house. He used to live on the Chesapeake Bay.
Uh-huh.
He's passed away, but for whatever reason, we were doing a mono scene or doing a scene in his living room.
Oh,
we're
wow.
all being crabs, or like, because we'd always have crabs, yeah. like blue crabs down there.
Who was in it?
I don't remember. It was very dimly lit.
Yeah.
But you know what? It was kind of predicted some of these house shows that happen around LA now.
Oh, really?
It actually felt very similar to a house show yeah. I did with Will Hines and Pam Murphy once.
Yeah.
Kind of like dimly lit sort of
yeah that's a new thing, right? That's kind of the rage, is doing like mm-hmm. improv and cabs and Ubers and
yeah
and limos and
backyard improv parties, yeah. And yeah, I've had a few times where it's like, come to my birthday party,
yeah,
and you're like, oh, I'll go to this person's birthday party, and then I look and there's a lineup of five improv teams,
yeah,
and then I'm like, I'm not going to that birthday party.
Yeah. Right.
I mean it's cool, it's fun,
yeah,
but I don't need to watch.
You've punched out of the day. You don't need to be.
At 9 p.m. on a Saturday, I don't need to go and watch five right. improv teams. Right. As much as I love the art form, I don't need to go and watch five.
When you do one of those, do you ever feel like, and I've done them, and I don't feel this way, but I'm asking if maybe you've run into this, where you feel like you are a birthday clown?
Like if you're performing at like a party
yeah.
or whatever?
Yeah.
I think the ones that I...
Make me laugh, monkey.
Yeah. The ones that I've done... That where it's all improvisers, I don't yeah. feel that way.
Right.
But the times that I've done like improv or whatever, one time going back to the rent fair, we all got paid to go to some rich person's like mansion mm-hmm. outside of Philadelphia mm-hmm. and
I've done these.
Yeah, yeah. And improvise as characters. Uh-huh. And that was weird.
Yeah.
That was the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
Another time I did that in, it was like the same group of people for Land Rover was having a convention or ooh, some
Land
sort
Rover.
Of thing. Land Rover. So we were at their little like sort of like Land Rover owner appreciation banquet, and then dressed as like Ren Faire characters, we had to go into the back of people's Land Rovers and go on an obstacle course out through the desert. I mean, not the desert, the
you
forest.
Sat in the back seat while
yeah.
they were going through an obstacle course?
A husband and wife were in the front seat. It was the strangest thing that's ever
that's
happened in my life.
Bizarre. And I
don't know.
You're commenting on it as the Scottish.
What is that? What is that? Is this thing here?
Yeah. Where's your horse?
This thing doesn't have a horse. There's no horse on this thing.
So your Ren Faire character was like a Guy Ritchie character.
Like, just like, oi.
That's great.
Fast talking schemes.
I was thinking, I asked a dream question because I was thinking of like, you're the artistic director. You do have a vision already that you're, you can't see this, but he's. His eyes are going crazy, cuckoo crazy.
Survival is my...
Yeah, that's your vision. But what, like, in your mind, if we didn't have to think of audiences or ticket sales or, you know, if we could go back to the punk rockness of it, what would be, what would you want to see on our stage?
I think something that I really like are smaller teams. Smaller teams where you have a few really, really good people doing stuff together. And I think you get that with the best groups of ASCAT when it's like four or five people with like a one monologist. You get that in some of, you know, getting like Neil Casey and Zach Woods doing Casey and Woods, just the two of them. You get that with, you know, like a small group like Cat Ladies, which is just Nicole Byer and Marcy Giroux, Madeline Walters. Like you get that when you have smaller groups of people doing shows. And you really get some shows that are like outstanding. I think one of the reasons that people love Wild Horses so much is and that's Aaron Whitehead and Lauren Lapkus and Mary Holland and Stephanie Allen, is that it's just the four of them.
Yeah.
So they really are these tight groups of performers that know each other super, super well.
Yeah.
And if we if I could, and I would have many more shows that were just two-person or three-person improv shows. Now, the reason – and we do have a lot of shows like that.
Yeah.
And the reason we can't have more shows like that is that we have a lot of great improvisers that need to get on stage. We have so many great people, you know, more great improvisers in New York and Los Angeles than we've ever had before. Yeah. And we need to make sure that we are getting – people on stage. We can't keep it so inside that it's like, oh, we don't have any stage time for you.
Yeah.
That said, you know, we're, you know, I'm always looking for ways to do two-person shows or do like, you know, three-on-three sort of stuff, ways that we get like smaller groups of people on stage. People really respond to that.
Even if they're doing like a montage where they're tagging and stuff like that, that it still feels more patient with less people.
Yeah.
It still feels like if you see a team of eight and they're just tagging in, you can't. There's a sense of disappointment, you know, that I feel watching a big team that is not patient with each other.
You want to see like, you always feel like someone's catching the cat.
Yeah.
Where sometimes you just want to see the cat land on its own. Right. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah.
Because there is like, everyone get each other's back. I got your 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 back.
I got your back.
I got your back. I got your back. And then everyone gets out on stage. It's like, and you're like, what the fuck?
What happened?
Is this, right? Yeah. Ideally, in an ideal world, and practically we can't do this because it would just be too hard to create ensembles like this. But I think Herald teams are better at five people.
Yeah.
I always say this. I'm like, it's the tradition is eight people. I think Herald teams are better with five people.
Yeah.
I think three people might be the ideal number of people to do improv in any sort of thing.
Yeah.
A great eight-person ensemble, you need to watch it. You need to watch many shows to really see their greatness or all the different facets of their greatness, because they'll have a great show. And you'll be like, but those two people I didn't see do much.
Right.
And they were doing a lot of support moves or they were like helping out.
Right.
So you need to watch two or three and you're like, okay, I see how all of these people are informing each other. And there's something cool about that. But I still sometimes think that the reason we say eight people is like every once in a while someone's going to miss because of a job or whatever. Or two people might miss. It's practical. Reason. So if you had five-person teams, you're doing a lot of – sometimes you'd have two- and three-person shows, and then you have to get guests, and it's like...
Yeah.
So that's why teams are a little bit larger is a little bit practical. Yeah.
And it makes sense, but you have that drawback for sure.
Yeah. If everyone could be there every single time, and it was like perfect attendance, no one ever got jobs or wasn't able to do shows, I would be like, let's do five-person Herald teams.
That would be a great world when no one got jobs and
just
there all the time doing improv for free.
That was it. Forever.
Yeah.
Free improv forever.
That'd be great.
That's heaven.
What else do I want to ask you? I wanted to ask, like, okay, I think we're winding down on time here, but you told me a little bit like what you'd like to see just as a fan of long form improv, but where do you think, long form is going? As an art form.
Good question.
I really threw you a loop right there.
No, that's good. As an art form, I think that, you know, kind of pulling out a bit from what can sometimes feel like an anthill of improvisers all trying to do a million different shows at a million different venues, right? You pull out a bit. The thing that people really love and respond to are shows that almost cleave more to some ideas of, in monoscenes, to bring back up monoscenes again, something that I have people do is like they can read Robert McKee's story. Mm-hmm. In order to like learn more about like what are some of the elements you have to create a narrative from nothing, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think that narrative itself is inherently good for doing improv. I think that there's things that we do when we're like writing scripts that we don't do when we're doing improv, right? But what it does do is it teaches us like, okay, this is a moment in a lot of stories where there is a breaking of like trust between the hero and the friend group or whatever, right? There's a breaking of trust in this like journey that this person is taking.
Yeah.
So I think thinking about things like from a real far perspective in terms of like the art of improv, that there as much as like people are getting very good at like applying game to doing scene work, like applying emotion and making sure that there is like a real groundedness in performance lets you do game better. Mm-hmm. And having understanding of how narratives work lets you make moves that are strong game moves and aren't – we're not plot-centric like this happens, then this happens, then this happens. It's more about like, oh, this is a situation that's happening. And from the perspective of top of our intelligence, what's something that would make this really heighten the game in a way that's mm-hmm. like – emotionally true for like these characters that really like connect, the audience is connected because they know these characters, they know this person is going after their want and they're not getting it right. They see that pattern of the joke or the game of the scene, and having understanding of like how narrative works or how it has worked in the past, that stuff for me is really cool. Mm-hmm. And performers that can meld those things, meld an understanding of playing game with an understanding of things that happen in narratives with an understanding of like emotional top of your intelligence play, that's where you get like stuff where you're like, oh, that's cool. That's different than anything I've seen. Mm-hmm.
And so we don't just get game, we get character development.
We get
maybe even getting into narrative.
Yeah.
Things that get resolved or satisfied in some way.
Satisfied in some way, I think, is the way of like thinking about it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, saying that, the pitfall of that is that you get people playing very plotty moves. You get very... You know, if someone's trying to do that in a Herald, they're going to have a second beat, which is like terrible because it's the game was about, make up a quick game here. It was about a baker who
I can't wait to hear the rest.
Yeah. What is this? It's always a baker doing something, right?
It is. It's always a baker.
I don't know. All right. Yeah. A baker who like thinks that people that like wheat bread is disgusting and is like commenting on it as people buy stuff there. Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, someone does the second beat where it's like, the next day,
right?
You know, and he's doing something else that has nothing to do with like the game of it, right? Yeah. And that's always the danger of talking about danger. That's a terrible word to use, and for what we do,
we're just grown-ups making stuff up.
Exactly, that's the pitfall of that sort of thing because people think, oh, I got a narrative, be a plot, and it's like, no, that's not why we look at how narratives are successful. We look at it for those ways to like heighten scenes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I like to use that word satisfy because I think that if we are if we're doing a Herald or any form and we just play the game and we don't understand anything about why or wherefore, it can have that not satisfying feeling.
Yeah.
We just like did game, we didn't explore anything.
I think about that. I think that's like very true. Like we make up we have these little contracts that we make with the audience that we don't even realize we're doing.
Yeah.
And if you're not satisfying, like, okay, well, people want to know who that person is. Yeah. Why did they do that?
Yeah.
You know? It's not – the scene isn't just about answering that why.
Yeah.
The why is a tool so you can then make those game moves and repeat – get into some sort of, like, really fun behavior. But, yeah, it is that satisfying thing. Like, we have all these – like, when people do something – one of my pet peeves and something I always talk to the Herald coaches about is long – intros or openings that add tons of information and then not you teams not using all that information.
Yeah.
So you need
Yeah, you're breaking a contract.
You're breaking a contract, yeah. And it's not satisfying.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like if you saw, you know, I'm thinking of like that, the video last year, Too Many Cooks, mm-hmm. that Adult Swim put out. And it, that's what it feels like. You're like, okay, you're introducing a million fucking characters, so many different people.
Yeah.
And there's going to be someone in the audience that really wants to see that baker.
Yes.
You know, you're going to see someone in the audience that really wants to see that other baker.
And then we hear about it in class when we're teaching. And they're like, they brought up the baker. And we never saw it.
Never saw it.
I'm fucking pissed.
It's like in the movie Carol, all right? They're given a gun, and then no one uses the gun. Someone likes, like, oh, you got a gun.
I didn't see Carol. There's a gun in Carol?
There's a gun in Carol. It's like they put
it
in.
It doesn't go
like,
off?
It's like a trick.
Oh. Well, I'm not seeing that now.
Yeah, don't see it. Again, I'm a war person.
What do you say? I get this question a lot when students come in and meet with me. And they're asking about a couple of things, but... One thing they're asking is, like, how do I get noticed around UCB? Don't answer that question.
Ugh.
Don't answer that question. Because this is about long-form improv. It's not about getting noticed by the artistic director. But what advice would you give to a young improviser who's just fallen in love with this and wants to grow and wants to make their own kind of stamp on it?
I think that you want to, you know, first of all, congratulations. Welcome to this world.
I don't know if congratulations is the right word, but...
Okay. my condolences.
Yeah, there you go.
So I think that something that I would say is to, first of all, identify what you like about improv. Why do you like it so much?
Yeah.
Right?
That's a really good question.
And then once you realize why you like it so much, oh, I get to create. Oh, I get to work with cool people. Oh, I like the spontaneity of it. Great. Keep doing improv. Do something else that creates an actual art, piece of art that doesn't just go away in a Zen garden sort of way.
Yeah.
Also do that thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be it writing a little bit or, you know, it's like I really like being able to get my opinions out there. Great. Write essays, you know, or write something from a very a personal standpoint. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I like the wackiness of it. Great. Keep doing improv. Also write in a way that's like wacky. Oh, I just like being in front of a audience and my full emotional range. Great. Make a web series where you get to do that as well.
Right.
My advice for people getting into this is do improv and also do the other thing because something that's kind of you know, we're talking about like old teams or old shows and stuff. And, you know, I brought up the one fucked up family Death by Ruru show where we have it on tape. It's there.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think now, 10 years or however long I've been doing this, longer than that, that I'm zen enough to not be a little sad and that all of this is just gone in the wind.
Yeah. It's Gossamer.
It's Gossamer, right? Ryan Gossamer.
It's Ryan Gossamer.
That's terrible. I don't know. Can we cut that? So
no.
That just
no.
undermined everything.
Don't cut that.
So I think that what's really important then is having improv as a way to create this beautiful art form on stage, these shows on stage, and making sure that at the same time you're creating things that are lasting.
Yeah.
Because the reason that you're probably being drawn to this is that you have a creative voice, that you have some sort of excitement to work with people and to collaborate instantaneously, which is what's happening in improv, and that's all wonderful, and you should indulge that, right? But you also need to have a way to, at least I do, and I'm glad whenever the things that have lasted, it's like great to have something that you're like, I made this, and this is mine. Mm-hmm. The other reason is because you're going to be developing great skills as an improviser that are, you know, that help you work and collaborate on stage and make this art, right? You need to show your work in some sort of way because outside of our improv world, people don't really care about that as much, you know, like
– Or at all.
Or at all.
Yeah.
Right? Like I was very fortunate to be on Death by Ruru and Fucked Up Family and Diamond Lion. There was a time where Diamond Lion was just like so popular here in L.A. Mm-hmm. People would just recognize on the street.
You guys were like the Beatles.
We're like the Beatles. We were the dorky improv Beatles. But then it doesn't matter. You can't be like – Let's show this to anyone. It's wonderful on its own.
Well, show me some of that. Well, we didn't tape any of it.
We didn't tape any of it.
We didn't write
exist.
Any of it down.
It's gone.
It's Ryan Gossamer.
Yeah, exactly. Total Ryan Gossamer. So then the other piece of advice is make sure you're performing with people you want to perform with, right? People that you really like, people that you're excited to perform with. Be the one that puts the group together. Be the one that like goes and talks to people and give yourself the space to, you know, perform. Like I think that right now it's hard in the indie scene and around because a lot of places only want to book, you know, 8-person teams or whatever, because then they're guaranteed that team's going to show up.
Right. It's turning into kind of like the bringer audience, like stand up, which is a drag.
It is, yeah.
It shouldn't be like that.
It's like, well, all right, book. And we even say that for shows in the Sanctum. We encourage people to have guest teams because we know then at least that guest team will be the audience for people. So my advice for people is to make your own shows that you can have like smaller groups of people play. And then also for showrunners, take a chance on some smaller number of people teams. Book the good ones. You know, not the book the terrible ones or whatever, right? Yeah. But like the people that you know are good, get them that space. Give people that. Like, let's all work together to give people the space to do some of these shows that you don't need like a team of 8 to 10 people up on stage bumping into each other.
Yeah. Great. That's good advice. I have advice too, but you can't hear it until I'm interviewed.
No? Well, what would?
No, I'm not going to do it.
You're going to wait?
Yeah, going to wait till the end of the world. We get the last.
The very final one.
When I'm interviewed.
During Civil War II.
No, I actually say a lot of the similar things that you say. So I want to give you a chance to make like a statement right now. If you want to correct anything that you said over the last hour, if you want to clarify anything, if you want to apologize for anything you've said, or you want to just say something really inspiring, do it now.
First of all, I'm sorry that I said Ryan Gosmore. It came out of nowhere. It was lame. It wasn't a good pun. Didn't add anything to it.
No one's going to want to work with you after this.
Yeah, I guess. I know. I feel like if I, you know, was a little quirkier of a person or like the weird voice and you're saying something, I'm like, Ryan Gosmore.
Yeah.
Everyone would laugh.
If you had like oversized eyeglasses.
Yeah.
And weird hair.
I wish, you know, I wish. My statement is give yourself space to do things. That's my statement. That's my inspiring statement. Yeah. Like this world, this UCB world and modern life can get very noisy. And it can feel as we have like this situation now as modern humans that we are connected with every other human on earth. Like you're literally, you could call, if you had the number of al-Baghdadi who runs ISIS, you could give him a call on your cell phone right now, right? So we're connected with every other human on earth, which means you got to hear from about everyone and everything, right? So know that that's not all for you. Like everything, you don't need to like absorb every single thing that's like out there. Because if you're a creative human, what you need to be doing is figuring out ways that you can create in the ways that you want to make things, that you want to make your art. You want to make your comedy. If you're a stand-up, you know, you want to write great jokes and give yourself time to do that. If you're an improviser, you want to make sure you're finding people that you enjoy playing with and make you laugh and then you can perform together. If you're a sketch comedian, you want to make sure that you're giving yourself the space to write and then to experiment with character. So my advice is give yourself space. Make sure that you're giving that space. Say no to things. Mm-hmm. Don't do every single thing out there. Mm-hmm. You know, what's cool about comedy is that we can remain sort of generalists, which means we do a bunch of different things like, okay, right? Mm-hmm. But figure out what you're really good at.
Yeah.
And give yourself a period of generalizing, you know, but then major in something. Say, I am going to do this specific thing, and this is what I'm going to do really well. I'm going to – you know what? I really love I want to work on a single-camera show. So I'm going to write for that and try to, you know, make a web series or whatever that is my version of that cool thing. Like, give yourself – like, major in something. That's my other piece of advice. Give yourself space when you're starting out so you're not just doing a billion things at once. And then eventually say, you know what, this is what I do, and I do this really well, and I'm very proud of it, and I'm digging into that. Which sometimes means, like, not being in the improv scene forever.
Yeah. Not doing every jam out there.
Not doing every jam for 15 years. Like, that's okay. Yeah. It's okay to say, you know what, great period of my life.
I think this is a good place to end because we said it's okay again.
It's like, okay.
Everything's okay.
We just come back to everything's okay.
Very 70s.
Yeah, man. Everything's okay.
You're okay.
Yeah, you're okay too.
Mike, it was my sincere pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Johnny.
You're a fascinating person.
Fascinating.
This has been the first the first, right? 1.0.
It's coming back.
Podcast for long-form improv in Los Angeles at UCB Theater. And it was great. You're a great guest. And now I'm handing you the hat.
Oh.
The host hat, which is just like a weird, like, top hat.
It's a cool top hat.
Yeah.
Velvet.
Who's that guy? Chris Angel. It's like a Chris Angel.
Abraham Lincoln?
Hat. Yeah. Well, I guess it's Abraham Lincoln. And you'll take over.
I'm taking over.
And here's the bad news, though. I've trademarked all of these questions that I asked you.
So I got to
come up with brand
new questions?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Sorry. Thanks, everybody, for listening. That's it.
You've been listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at UCBtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy. This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.